walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Jessica Rubin, a professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, who's at the forefront of a new law in that state that allows judges to appoint legal advocates for abused animals, not unlike the process by which courts appoint advocates for children. Rubin is one of eight people in Connecticut who have been approved to serve as these legal advocates. They're all volunteers, and the judge determines whether to appoint an animal legal advocate in any given case. Advocates are able to interview witnesses and experts, write briefs, and make recommendations to a judge. We'll hear about this new law, the only such law in the country, her role as an animal legal advocate, and more when I speak with Jessica Rubin in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll also speak with Ted Coran of the Critter Place, a sanctuary in Weekiwachee, Florida, where he's caring for nearly 70 animals single-handedly and would certainly welcome help of one kind or another. Talked to Ted a couple of times before on the show over the years, and because he's now facing some formidable challenges, thought it'd be important to get an update today. Right now, though, let's get to Professor Rubin and advocates speaking on behalf of abused animals with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Jessica Rubin to Talk Animals. Good morning, Professor Rubin.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. So we'll chiefly, of course, be discussing this relatively new Connecticut law that does allow judges to appoint advocates for abused animals, and that animal law is an area of particular interest and expertise for you and when you teach at the law school there. But it may be useful to establish some context first for your work in those areas by exploring your feelings about animals outside the courtroom and the classroom. So how important were animals to you growing up?
Sure. I've been a lifelong animal rights advocate, first in a personal dimension and eventually in a professional legal dimension. So growing up, my mother ran a rescue organization out of our house, and so foster dogs and rescue dogs was a part of my upbringing. And in my high school years, I became vegan and have been since then, and then in college became more of an activist and spent some time working with some prominent people in the field, with Peter Singer, with Steve Wise. So it's always been a part of my personal belief system. When I became a lawyer, I had the opportunity to do some pro bono animal rights work, and then when I started teaching at UConn Law School, I began teaching animal law, and then most recently developing this new animal advocacy program.
Well, we're going to explore at least some of those things in more detail. I just want to back up a little bit, because it sounds like, for one thing, that looking after the welfare of animals is not only kind of genetically oriented, but that you grew up right there with the rescue in the house. So did you feel a particularly strong attachment or kinship to those animals when your mom was running that rescue? Or was it just like, wow, we just have a house full of animals and I'm just helping out and I love them all? But
no, it was a smaller scale rescue. So we only had usually one or two at a time. So
okay.
Absolutely. There was a great bond. They were long term, usually ill dogs, so we've really had a chance to bond with them. And of course, as children cry when they went to their forever homes. So it was a good experience. And yes, it's absolutely in my genes, because my cousins are similarly, you could say, blessed or afflicted.
Yeah, for sure. Apart from the one or two at a time that you had as part of that sort of small rescue operation, were there also animals that were ongoing family members in addition?
Absolutely. We were a dog family, so
yeah.
We've had dogs. We have some feral cats that my mother continues to take care of. But this rescue group and my upbringing was before the internet, so that in addition to running this dog rescue operation, my mother was usually the, the recipients of the phone calls that the police department did not want to handle. So when people called about an injured swan on the road or an injured squirrel, we would pack up in the car and do what we could to pick up the animal and give it veterinary attention. So she was sort of the go-to person in the community.
And in a sense, then, you've, again, not only the genetically, but sort of, I think, sounds like from watching that and helping out on those things, just launched yourself in that direction as you left the nest and went to school, and sounded like you got involved in activism pretty much early on.
Yes, and it's been nice to join the personal belief system with the professional activities. And
yeah.
I feel lucky that I've been able to do that.
And with that in mind, when you decided to go to law school, was it always with the thought, at least some part of what I will do once I get my law degree will be dealing with and serving the interests of animals in some way?
Yes.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it did not happen immediately after law school. I finished law school and went to work for a large private law firm and was able to do a small amount of animal work on the side on a pro bono volunteer basis. And only over time was I able to build that up and do more and more volunteer work and then start teaching at UConn. So it was not an immediate thing, which I think is important for people to hear, that sometimes patience and perseverance yields a good reward in the end.
Right. Well, and also sometimes experience, including having experiences, you think, okay, well, these are fine as far as they go, but I actually think I'm going to be more personally inspired if I kind of head over this direction.
Right.
And it sounds like that's indeed what happened. So let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tune in, my guest is Jessica Rubin, a professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a pivotal figure in a relatively new Connecticut law that allows judges to appoint advocates for abused animals in court cases. Professor Rubin is one of eight such advocates. If you'd like to ask Professor Rubin a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So one of the problems we see in a range of issues we discuss on this show over the years is the fundamental legal definition of animals as property, and therefore animals can be used or treated or mistreated any way the owner of that property sees fit. And there are a number of efforts underway to help mitigate that. You mentioned Steve Wise as someone that you've been lucky enough, I guess, to work with in his non-human rights organization and sort of attempting to establish personhood for those two captive chins at the moment still, and other animals. This new law that you've been involved with that we really want to focus our conversation on today would seem to aim to tilt things a bit in the other direction, giving abused animals better prospects of justice and more voices speaking on their behalf. Is that, just as an overall assessment, is that about right?
Well, this advocacy law does not try to change the status of animals. I think the Non-Human Rights Project is doing terrific and amazing work to mention.
Yeah.
This works within the system to do something else, to create different benefits. However, even though animals technically are categorized as legal property, the cruelty laws that exist in every state, the anti-cruelty laws, already acknowledge that there are some limitations on that property status. You can't do anything you want, right?
Right.
You can't commit acts of cruelty against your animal as you could against your book. So I think inherent in those anti-cruelty laws is a nod to the fact that this is a special kind of property. It's not the equivalent to a car or a book.
Well, that's right. But it does seem that nonetheless, a lot of what happens to animals is maybe short of what many of us would define as cruelty, but sometimes people don't take the greatest care of their cars either.
Right.
So this law is the first of its kind in the U.S. Kind of describe the law in more detail and how it came to be.
Sure. The law, as you very aptly described at the beginning, the law allows, doesn't require, but allows a court in a cruelty case involving a cat or a dog to appoint an advocate to advocate for the interests of justice. And the advocate position can be filled by either a volunteer lawyer or a law student acting under supervision. So that's generally what the law allows. And then how the law came into being was really a product of a collaboration between myself and State Representative Diana Urban, who comes from the southern shore of Connecticut. And Diana and I had been working for many years together in my animal law course and came up with the idea that to respond to the under-prosecution of animal cruelty cases in Connecticut, like every other state, we could equip the court with volunteer advocates. And Diana had a son who was in law school in Washington, D.C. at the time and had done some volunteering in court there. And so she got the idea that we could use law students to fill this advocate position. And we worked on a draft of legislation, and she introduced it for 3 consecutive years, and in the 3rd year, it finally passed.
Once again, we see how slowly sometimes legislation churns along to get passed. But so when you and Diana, I remember, were having those kind of conversations, who hatched the original idea? Did someone one day just say, hey, what if someone could act as comparable to a guardian ad litem, but in this case for an abused animal? Or what was sort of the first discussion or the first premise as you guys got going on this?
Really, it was a response to, I would say, 2 factors. One was this long-standing statistic in Connecticut of our animal cruelty cases not proceeding to trial. They get dismissed. 80% of them get dismissed. And that was really frustrating and a long-term problem. The second factor was we had a case involving a dog named Desmond, who was strangled, beaten, starved, and eventually killed by an angry boyfriend, who the girlfriend relinquished the dog to a pound, and the boyfriend then adopted the dog, abused the dog, and killed the dog. And that individual was charged with animal cruelty, and the court allowed that defendant to use what we call the accelerated rehabilitation program, which means that after 2 years of no further offenses, his record is wiped clean. And many, many, many animal advocates in our state were very upset with that outcome, so that the defendant in that case now has a perfectly clean record and can go to a pound, can go to a store, can acquire additional animals without any evidence of his past action. And so Diana's idea of using student volunteers, my idea of more aggressively handling cruelty cases, and the advocates community in our state that was so upset by this outcome in the Desmond case, really got together and, you know, were very active in lobbying in support of this bill and succeeded in the end. So it was really a confluence of the long-term statistics, the case involving Desmond, and from a legal education perspective, there's a great movement in all of legal education to give students more experiential learning opportunities, putting them in court and real lawyering situations. And this, I thought, was a great opportunity to put students in court doing meaningful work.
Sure. So as you're recounting this, those of us who are extremely partial to animals might imagine that this idea and the bill that you guys conceived would have received immediate and wide support, especially if it was hooked to this horrible Desmond story. And yet I got the sense that in some quarters was muted enthusiasm and in others sort of outright opposition to this. Can you talk a little about these opponents and what their objections seem to be?
Sure. Some of the objections that we heard included a concern that this bill confused the standing of animals, and so that it would be unclear in court who was the actual party, which I do not think is an accurate objection. Another objection was that this is coming close to giving animals standing and legal personhood. A third objection was that if animals achieve personhood, then owners' rights to do what they want will be compromised and restricted. And so those were the opposition that we heard came from the Connecticut Dog Federation, the Connecticut Veterinary Medical Association, which surprised me initially, but then I realized that the greater legal treatment animals achieve, the more liability veterinarians could face. So I think that's where that was from.
Okay. But it is interesting how already we've circled or at least brushed up against the personhood thing. Again, in this case, that was one of someone's objections to the bill. But anyway, so the laws did finally pass. So now, how exactly does it work? I mean, I believe there are 8 people that are designated as these volunteer advocates, including yourself?
Sure. The law passed in May, and it went into effect on October 1st. And immediately, I registered UConn Law School as a potential advocate. Our State Department of Agriculture maintains an online list of available volunteer advocates. So I put UConn up there and encouraged lawyers to volunteer. So all somebody has to do to volunteer is contact the Department of Agriculture and ask to be put on the list. In a cruelty case, the prosecutor, the defendant's lawyer, or the court can decide, the prosecutor or the defendant's lawyer, can ask the court to appoint an advocate, or the court can do it on its own. And the court would just look who's on the list and select an advocate to appoint in the case, contact the advocate, and then the advocate could begin his or her work.
It sounds like there's been a fair amount of discussion and obviously debate, as we've touched on, and drafting and reshaping the bill did finally pass. So I need to explain kind of the mechanics, but I believe there's been at least one case so far under this law, maybe more that I'm not aware of. How did it actually work in practice? Tell us at least maybe about the first case under the law.
Under the law, and the second case appointed UConn Law School as the advocate. And the first case involved a defendant who was accused of dogfighting. And the prosecutor in that case suggested to the court the appointment of the advocate, and the court agreed. And so UConn, I was contacted. And I have two students who work with me as advocates, and we began the process of researching the facts of the case beyond what was in the police record. So that included interviewing the animal control officer, the police officer, and the veterinarian who were involved in the case. And those interviews give us a chance to gather facts and then present them to the court in greater depth than the police report may be able to do. So that's one role that the advocate serves, is researching the facts and presenting a deeper factual story to the court. The second part of what we did as advocates was make sentencing recommendations to the court, what we thought the court should do in this case if the defendant was found guilty of the accused charge. And so we made those arguments in a written document to the court, and also made them orally to the court when we had the opportunity.
So UConn comes up amongst others, but when they do, is it that you're having law students of yours under your supervision kind of fill this role?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we work as a three-person team, two law students and myself, and you know, I'm supervising all of their work. I'm right next to them in court, and I try not to speak because it's their opportunity.
Right.
But I'm there. Their backup if necessary.
This is Talking Animals of Duncan Strauss. My guest is Jessica Rubin, a professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, and one of the volunteer advocates under a relatively new Connecticut law who may be appointed by judges to speak on behalf of abused animals in court cases. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So when you explained how the advocate is brought into a certain case, why wouldn't a prosecutor in an animal abuse case ask a judge to appoint an advocate? I mean, doesn't this sort of, on the one hand, you know, lighten the load of overworked attorneys in those jobs? And I would think at least boost the prospects of a conviction or triumphing in that case?
Absolutely. It's basically an extra resource for the court and the prosecutor. And it's great work for law students because it's very time-consuming work. For example, to go and interview a veterinarian is time-consuming because you know, they're busy professionals, and usually my law students spend a lot of time sitting in the waiting room waiting for the vet to have 5 minutes to talk. That's time-consuming work, and it's great work for law students. A prosecutor might be reluctant to use the law. Number one, it's a new law. A lot of prosecutors are just figuring it out and understanding it. Number two, there may be concern that you know, there's going to be overlapping responsibilities, overlapping activities, and maybe a prosecutor would be reluctant to involve an extra party at the table, so to speak.
So that's maybe more the product than, I guess, as you suggest, of it being new and people getting the hang of it. Because I guess back to my original question is that if I'm an overworked prosecutor, which I think almost is redundant, why wouldn't I say, wow, I got an animal abuse case here on the top of my gigantic stack of case files. Why wouldn't I contact Professor Rubin or another advocate and get that kind of help? I mean, is there any downside from a prosecutor standpoint?
I hope everybody agrees with you.
Yeah, okay.
So the only downside, as I said, is someone might feel like it's complicating things to add an additional party.
Sure, yeah, I understand. But again, I would think if, I don't know who the other advocates are that they could select, but I would think if they select you, knowing that, yeah, it's going to be one of your law students, but you're going to be, the buck will probably ultimately stop with you, so that it's not going to be, oh my God, yeah, I've got help, but I've got a mess to untangle from the person that helped me.
Right, and so far in the first two cases, they were in Hartford, Connecticut Community Court, and the prosecutor, Tom O'Brien, was fabulous. We worked very well together, and he's a huge supporter of the program. So far, it's gone well.
And I'm sorry if I missed this. Well, I think I know what the outcome of the first case was. If you said, I'm sorry, I might have missed it. What was the outcome of the second case?
There is no outcome yet.
Oh, okay. All right. Then I didn't miss it. Okay, good. All right. Well, let's get some callers involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Professor Rubin.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. I got a couple questions real quick. I don't want to take any time off. What kind of laws do we have in Florida here that you can be arrested for getting rid of vermin? You know, animals, wild animals that come into your yard and destroy stuff, like raccoons and like pigeons. Pigeons especially. Are they protected?
Well, Professor Rubin's welcome to answer, but again, she's in Connecticut, and we're talking about Connecticut law. So,
oh, okay.
There may be a general answer that you might have, Professor Rubin, but if not, we might have to direct that question elsewhere with more of a Florida emphasis.
Yeah, I can't speak to Florida's particular law. Many cruelty statutes have exemptions for pest control, but I don't know what the Florida cruelty statute looks like.
But you can't really catch pigeons. They flock to my house in 5 to 10 at a time, and they just keep coming more and more over by bird feeder, and they're just making such a mess. It's terrible, and I'm ready to go out there with a BB gun and stun them just to get them out of here, you know? But they just keep coming back. I mean, is there? I didn't know. Are pigeons protected in the United States? No.
I don't really know. I would try to do some online research, but I think this question is taking kind of a horrible turn here. So
my neighbors are looking at me funny, and I don't want to go to prison over shooting a pigeon.
Yeah, well, I would certainly highly recommend that you don't shoot the pigeons regardless, but we do need to get back to our conversation here. Thank you so much for your call. Professor Rubin, sorry. We got one question here from an emailer that I think I would suspect what the answer would be, but my legal career ended when I saw my LSAT score, so I probably could be way off on this. But this one says simply, would puppy mills fall into this category?
Would puppy mills fall in? If there was, absolutely, if there were cruelty that could be prosecuted in that situation, there's not an exemption.
Right, but wouldn't there have to be, I guess, a specific dog, or maybe, I guess, within reason, group of dogs, but otherwise it would get, I would think, unwieldy, I mean, just by the nature of puppy mills. But it sounds like you're saying, hey, if someone did somehow bring a case with one dog especially that represented, I guess, the puppy mill and the abuse that that dog underwent in that puppy mill, that could qualify?
Right, and there would be, hopefully, multiple charges for multiple dogs. In fact, the first case that we had, the dog fighting case, involved three dogs, so we had three charges of cruelty. So in a puppy mill situation, there could be 100 charges of cruelty.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, let's take another caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, Professor Rubin.
Oh, hi. I just had a question and an observation. I worked in the government for a long time, and mostly environmental inspections, which crosses over sometimes into animal control. And so I worked closely with animal control in the past. And I just think that animal control needs to start taking a different role. And, this advocacy program, could work with animal control programs around the country and, to monitor closer who owns these animals, how they get licensed to, the owner needs a license to own the animal instead of the animal being licensed. I don't know. I just think it needs an overhaul, the thinking of it.
That's a great point. And as two outgrowths of this legislation, we're doing something in Connecticut that I hope will spread. We are going to offer training to our animal control officers and prosecutors about how to document cases properly. And now with the possibility of these cases being more vigorously prosecuted, my hope is that animal control officers have motivation to more aggressively monitor animals in their jurisdiction.
A lot of times I know that just working with animal control officers, a lot of times, and I hate to say it, but they're not really there as an animal advocate. It's just a job to them. And another observation that I have, because I do environmental reviews, is that it seems like there's stricter laws on what people can do with their trees in their own yard than, how they treat their animals. It just has to change.
Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your call. That's great about the training. I mean, to me, this seems like it's having like a cool ripple effect with now that you mentioned the training of the animal control officers. So I guess that makes me wonder about a broader ripple effect. Are you aware of friends, colleagues, others in other states watching how this plays out? Or even is there a similar law in the works in one or more other states that you're aware of?
I've been, since we've gotten a lot of media attention in the last couple of months, I've been contacted by advocates in a few other states. And my hope, as I've said, is that this spreads across the country. It's
yeah.
a very hard program to oppose because it
right.
really is a win-win situation. The courts and the prosecutors get extra help,
yeah.
and lawyers and law students get to do meaningful, important work.
Well, as I said a little more glibly a moment ago, I mean, what's the downside for that prosecutor and therefore, yeah, for other states? Again, why wouldn't they embrace this? Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Professor Rubin.
Yeah, hey, I think that last caller bled over into what you might have already said, because I only started listening about 15 minutes ago, but animal personhood, animal sentience, just the acknowledgement that we, as our species, wasn't here first. And, of course, now that humans have been transferring organisms around the planet for hundreds of years, there really isn't a pristine, native, intact ecosystem anywhere. But just the whole attitude of animal control officers and these pest so-called vermin control companies and the laws that enable them, and the way that most of us view animals as property, if not impediments, annoyances, bothers. I mean, the pigeons, they don't intend to be a nuisance, and bird feeders themselves disrupt natural cycles of bird behavior. I'm glad to see that you, the professor, are starting to say to the courts and others, you know, these animals have feelings, families, language, social structure. They want to live and be free of pain and fear just like we do. When are we going to acknowledge their rights? As you said, tree cutting is more regulated than harming animals.
All right, thanks for your call and your observation. Professor Rubin, any response you'd like to offer to that?
Sure, I wholeheartedly agree. And what we started the show talking about was that, you know, this new statute is not a change in personhood for animals, but it is a way to more vigorously prosecute and enforce the cruelty statutes that we have. And those cruelty statutes acknowledge that we can't do anything we want with animals. So it is a nod to acknowledging greater sentience while not going all the way to legal personhood.
Right. And by the way, since the pigeons and bird feeder has come up again, I will say that we've already had one text and one email that the text simply said, get rid of his bird feeder. Someone perhaps with a little more patience and suggestions in mind said, the caller who is having a pigeon problem could easily eliminate the bird feeder and instead plant things that provide food and shelter for the birds. If you enjoy seeing non-pigeons in the yard, you could try a bird bath instead. Birds are perfectly capable of finding food sources on their own, but fresh water can't always be found. Professor Rubin, let me ask you this. You talked about growing up really loving and feeling connected to animals and having sort of the in-house small but mighty rescue and shelter and some of your work subsequently. With that in mind, what concerns do you have? Because I'm going to assume at least some of the law students that have volunteered for this program under your supervision probably have similar feelings about animals. So what sort of concerns do you have about them and yourself even dealing directly with or seeing some of these animal abuse cases and where in many instances there's pretty unspeakable abuse that's been visited upon these animals, and just seems like there'd be a certain amount of, over time at least, a certain amount of emotional wear and tear that would go with reading, seeing, hearing about what happened to these animals?
That's a great question and one that did not occur to me. I was so focused on the legislation and getting this law passed that when we were handed our first case, I brought it home and sat down to read it, and I thought, exactly what you said, what did I get myself and my law students into? Because now we've got to look at this very, you know, unspeakable evil and this very disturbing record. So absolutely, that was my experience. However, I feel it's necessary to enforce justice against, you know, the defendants in these cases, but also create, you know, a by virtue of more vigorous prosecution, create a deterrent effect so that the next time someone down the road considers doing something cruel to an animal, my hope is that they will realize that this case, their case, will be vigorously prosecuted and handled and sentenced. So, yes, it's very unpleasant, but it's worth it.
Well, you're achieving ultimately and making sure that these people that do, I guess, commit these kinds of things are responsible and have whatever punishment is, I guess, available under the law.
Right, and I think turning a blind eye to evil would be a very selfish course of action.
For sure.
You know, it would be protective of myself and my students, but would not accomplish any greater goal, greater good.
Gotcha.
So it's a necessary evil to look at the evil.
Right. So what kind of, just generally, what is kind of profile are we looking at for the students of yours that have gravitated this? I assume that you have X amount of students that you teach at the law school there, but did you just say, hey, I've been working on this, the law passed, if you're interested, contact me, or is there more of a screening process? How do you determine who's going to work alongside you in these things?
Well, initially, when the legislation was proposed, I put out a request to our Student Animal Legal Defense Fund. I was looking for students to testify. And one in support of the legislation, one student stepped forward, and she did a wonderful job testifying before our legislature. So when the opportunity came up to staff the position, I contacted her for two reasons. She's passionate about animal rights, and she's a wonderful speaker in court. She's comfortable in court, and she's quick, and her name is Taylor Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, I have a second student who's been very involved in our Student Animal Legal Defense Fund. Her name is Julie Shema Ilova, and she also is passionate about animal rights, has experience volunteering for the Humane Society, and I tapped her. So the two of them, it was a combination of my tapping them and them volunteering. So they've been the two students to serve as the first advocates in the first and second case, and now I have a third case, and so I've reached out to other students who I thought would do a great job. So it's a combination of students presenting themselves with interest and experience and my identifying who I think would be both passionate about the cause but also good in court and writing.
Professor Rubin, with the initial, I think there was eight initial advocates that were appointed under this program. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So one of those slots, one of those eight, in other words, is you, but I gather that you have within that the discretion and room to say, okay, my slot, I'm going to designate Taylor, or I'm going to designate Julie. They will be under my supervision. So in a sense, it's more than eight because you can get other people involved along the way as cases do surface.
Right. And technically on the list, UConn Law School is registered as the advocate. I wanted the institution to be the advocate so that I had that freedom to staff it.
I see. And so everybody, when those designations were made, everybody understood that that would happen and were comfortable with the fact that that would involve law students under your purview.
Right. Yeah. And the statute specifically says law students under supervision is one way to staff the advocate position.
Great. So are the other seven people just lawyers of various kinds, or what is their, I'm sure you know them, so what are their descriptions?
Lawyers who believe in animal rights and want to do this on a volunteer basis.
I gotcha. So we're in our last moment or two here, but just going to read a couple quick emails. One says, very good program and good progress for animals. Another says, God, I wish this law could spread around the country. Thank you for your great work. So back to that, obviously asked about that a moment ago, but what do you think, I mean, as people watch now, it sounds like the third case under the law is about to start. Again, do you think it's just sort of a foregone conclusion that states, as they've watched how this has gone, will say, okay, this is working, this is good, and again, no downside, plenty of upside. Let's get going.
I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I think it's going to take advocates in each state working with legislators in each state to draft and propose a similar law in their states. And I hope that happens. I hope everybody who's listening can reach out to advocates and legislators in their states to do that. And I think it's going to take a lot of work. It took a lot of work in Connecticut, several tries, and so we shouldn't assume that it's going to happen easily. I think people need to do a lot of work, a lot of lobbying to make it happen.
I'd like to think that with the work that you did do and prevailed with some of the opposition, even though, again, in other states there'll be comparable or different opposition, but I would think that in all these kinds of situations, people say are looking to see if something succeeds before they say, all right, let me try to get this bill going. But it did succeed, so they can point to that. So it doesn't mean like it's going to sail through, but I would think that would really, really help any subsequent efforts in other states.
And I hope that we can point to some successes in Connecticut in actual outcomes of cases to
yeah.
support efforts in other states.
I would think even that there's this kind of attention and help and more focused effort on those kind of abuse cases would be notable, even if they're not a triumph per se.
Yes, but I want it all.
Yes, I know. I want the triumph too, buddy. Yeah, come on, listen up here. So, okay, well, this, again, I think this is a really great work, and I'm just so glad that you've done this and are doing this. And I just think those law students are just so fortunate to also to have that kind of experience so that when they graduate, they too can go off and help animals and do other things or whatever else they might do. But I'm sure it's going to include that based on them being drawn to these cases. So, Jessica Rubin, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. We've been speaking with Professor Jessica Rubin. She's a professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. And thank you so much for your great efforts. And thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Ted Koran, who will update us on the status of the Critter Places Sanctuary in Weekiwatchee, where he single-handedly cares for upwards of 70 animals, and he could use some help. Let's just understate that, but one kind or another. So I'll speak to him momentarily. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece that was one of my favorites from the earliest years of Talk Animals, though frankly I'd kind of forgotten about it. This is a piece I've called Alternative Pets from Paul F. Tompkins in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
People have their alternative pets on their person. It's people walking around with animals on their body, just hanging out. And I guess you're supposed to have some reaction to these people. You know, I guess what they want you to say is something like, well, pardon me, sir. Is that a bird on your shoulder? Well, you must be one fascinating individual. Your personality is not at all manufactured. I say, what if we were to exchange addresses and became pen pals? That way I could collect your letters in a bound volume entitled, My Correspondence with the Most Interesting Person Alive. Working hard for you. That's great. You can have any animal that you want, you know, because we have dominion over the beasts of the fields and all, you know, but here's the thing. Even animals need some alone time, okay? How about that, you know? Maybe the lizard would like to sit at home, play on the rock for a while, you know? Maybe the bird would like to play with the bell, look in the mirror for a little bit. Maybe they don't have to come with you on all your jackass errands. How about that? Leave them alone for a minute. Come on, Cecil, we're going down to the bank so everybody can see your crazy eyes. Woo!
That was Paul F. Tompkins with a piece I call Alternative Pets, taken from an appearance many years ago on Comedy Central. Now on to my conversation with Ted Koran of The Critter Place. Indeed, let's welcome Ted back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thank you for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Well, I appreciate all the people that you talk to who advocate for animals, and I do appreciate what you do and what all the other people do.
And we likewise appreciate what you do, which is why I wanted to speak with you again today. Just for people who may not have heard some of our other conversations over the years, let's just start by giving us maybe a brief overview of the Critter Place. How did it start? What kind of animals are there?
Well, it started, 30 years ago with a horse named Ruby, and it just kind of evolved into what it is today. We just kept taking in animals that nobody else would take, and kind of the throwaway animals. And today I have 68 animals I'm caring for. I guess that's kind of a short overview.
Yeah, what kind of animals amongst those 68? Just give us kind of a little bit of a feel for what kind of animals make up that population.
Let's see, 4 horses, 5 variety of piggies, 8 dogs, mostly kitty cats, about 40 kitty cats, mostly in my cat house, and a few outside, and let's see, can't forget my potluck goose and my pidgey pigeon.
Wow. Okay, well, that does cover quite a range. So what, that's a lot of animals, 68 animals. Now, what kind of volunteer force do you have there helping you feed and clean and care for those 68?
Oh, I wish I did have a volunteer force. I have a few dedicated ones, volunteers, and I always appreciate their company and the way they love on the animals, so it's always a pleasure to have somebody come and volunteer and even just visit. It's a pretty busy day for me all the time. I got it pretty organized and got a pretty good routine. All the animals are nice and healthy, and a lot of things have kind of gotten worn and old, you know, just like me, that need repairing and a lot of maintenance and upkeep I haven't been able to keep up with in the last year or two. So, but the animals are always priority, and they always get the attention, and I take care of all their needs.
Right. Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, but not in this conversation, we haven't mentioned so far, that you're located in Weekiwatchee. So I've gathered over the years that the one difficulty for getting more volunteers, and obviously you appreciate the ones that do make it out there to help out and like you say, just visit, is it's remote. It's difficult, I guess, for people to get out there. And yet some people may not be aware of the critter place and the kind of help that you could use. So it sounds like always you could use some help with the animals under your guidance, but you mentioned some things in disrepair. What are some other volunteer tasks if someone's listening and says, you know what, I got some time on a Saturday coming up, I could go out and help Ted. What are some other tasks in addition to helping care for the animals that you could really use some help with?
Oh, I need a few piggy houses rebuilt. There's always fencing.
Yeah.
I got about 3 miles of fencing around my property in the cross fencing. And of course there's the horse shelters, the barns. I never got to build the run-in, that I would like for my two larger horses. And I got a storage building that was built 40 years ago that's almost about to cave in, so I had to resort to using a storage tent. They're pretty inexpensive, and I set them up on a wooden deck and tie them down, and they're adequate for the time being. They probably last a couple of years. Boy, the variety of things that need to be done in a sanctuary like mine is kind of endless. It's never ending, continuous maintenance and upkeep, and so it keeps me busy.
Well, so I guess the best place to kind of find out more about the Critter Place, and also maybe to a means to contact you to see about helping out in some way, volunteering, would be the Facebook page, the Critter Place Facebook page, I guess, is sort of the best way to do that. Is that correct?
Well, that's where I'm active.
Yeah.
Daily, I go around the sanctuary and just take random shots, and then I upload them to my computer, and I say, wow, isn't that a cute one?
Yeah.
I have over 6,000 fans and worldwide, and it's quite humbling knowing that so many people around the world are watching my animals, and it really makes me feel good, and it's heartwarming.
Well, that's really good to hear, because it seems like of late, I probably don't catch all your posts, but I catch most of them, and it just seems like you're just been sort of in a tougher time.
Well, everybody goes through tough times. I'm not alone. As you know, I lost my wife 2.5 years ago. That was a tough. That was extremely tough. I still shed a tear every day.
Yeah,
she was definitely my better half.
Right.
And I've had some few physical issues from a lifelong career of heavy construction. Then an accident kind of, what I say, broke the camel's back, made it difficult. A recent diagnosis of a few things kind of makes you wonder about your mortality, and my main concern is getting help for the animals so I can keep them here with me, no matter what happens.
Well, I think with that in mind, if I'm not mistaken, some of those 68 animals that I think you feel particularly close with, or because of your late wife that you alluded to and pledge or promise you'd made to her, that some of those you wouldn't really want to see live elsewhere or relocate elsewhere, but at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, some of those 68 you would be willing to adopt out if people could give some homes to some of those 40 cats, for example, or some of those dogs. Is that right?
Yeah, there I have a few. The ones that Karen personally touched when she was still here. The promise that she asked me a few hours before she left us was not to give up the animals, and that was referring to the ones that we had at the time.
Sure.
And not to give up the sanctuary. I think we did a lot of good in 30 years, rescuing over 1,500 animals, and my wish is to let the legacy of the Critter Place continue. When I'm gone, then, and if the Critter Place doesn't continue, then that's 1,500 animals in the future that just won't get saved, because we were their last resort, literally.
Well, like you said in your earlier description, many of them were sort of the throwaway animals that didn't have anywhere else to go or had been other places, and that didn't work out. And so, thankfully, they landed at the Critter Place. We have just maybe a bit less than a minute now, Ted, so I'm just going to sort of review for people listening that, again, if they go to the Facebook page, just search for the Critter Place. So, again, maybe you could help out with some volunteer time and effort there. Maybe there's a way to donate directly on the Facebook page. There might be some help in that way you could offer, and also maybe some of these animals that are ones that Ted would be willing to adopt out. Maybe this is a good time to sort of lighten that load and find some good homes for some of those animals that are ready to relocate from the Critter Place. So I think all those things can be done. You can contact Ted through the Critter Place Facebook page. And Ted, good luck to you and keep up the great work. And again, you've been an amazing man on behalf of all our animal friends over, you know, all those years and 1,500 animals. Wow, very impressive. So thank you and good luck. And we'll keep in touch, and we'll hopefully follow up and see if we can get some other help out there soon.
I appreciate it, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lurie and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, and news, and more, including in the new hour, Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp, Executive Session. And next week on Talking Animals, Priscilla Farrell, president of Friends of Animals, an international animal advocacy organization headquartered in Connecticut. Friends of Animals was founded in 1957. Means it's celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, and Farrell has been working there for 43 years, president for 30 of those years. So unusually long histories and great stories, and that's all next Wednesday on Talk Animals. Please visit TalkAnimals.net for archives of every broadcast, every show we've ever broadcast, and there's also links there for Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. And you can also subscribe to our e-newsletter that way. So, I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Get your tickets right this minute for Alejandro tonight at Skipper's. I'll see you there. WMNF Tampa.